This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow.
Futurama. General Motors Futurama at the New York World's Fair, where you meet the future face to face. It's an experience you'll never forget, because the fantastic Futurama ride takes you into the future and makes you feel like you're there, in outer space, beneath the sea, in unbelievable places, watching believable things happen. Many of the futuristic things you'll see are already more than just a part of the General Motors Futurama exhibit. They're demonstration models, in a sense, of scientific ideas being developed now. Stroll down our avenue of progress and see this kind of product on display.
Wow, do you remember the 1964 World's Fair? Well, you couldn't have future music without that scary music. And it's 40 years since they swung, opened the gates in Flushing Meadow Park, and 65 years since that same spot attracted visitors to the 1939 fair. And just like in that commercial for GM's Futurama, you know, I still have that button that says, I have seen the future from there. The World's Fair, you know, besides being a large commercial for exhibitors, after all, that really is what it was, it did really challenge us to imagine the future. What do you remember about the World's Fair? What impact did it have on you, and how much of the future that we saw at those fairs, from the first exhibition of television and FM radio in 1939, also we saw nylon at that 1939 World's Fair. We also had undersea houses at World's Fairs. Remember, cars of the future? We had, supposedly we were all going to have a little helicopters we'd fly ourselves. Whatever happened to some of those predictions? Why did some come true and some did not? What do you think? Our number, 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. Let me introduce my guests. David Gelernter is a professor of computer science at Yale University and a board member of the National Endowment for the Arts. He's the author of 1939, The Lost World of the Fair, published by Free Press. He joins us by phone. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Thank you.
Thank you. Does it feel like all that time has passed for you?
yes and no.
All right, William Young is also with us. He is co-author of the forthcoming book, Images of America, 1964-65 New York World's Fair. He joins us by phone from Wisconsin. Thank you for talking with us today.
Thank you, Ira. It's nice to be on.
40 years go by quickly for you?
Yeah, 40 years goes by quickly for everyone, doesn't it?
What do you think was the hallmark of the 64-65 World's Fair?
Well, I think of the fair, one of the greatest legacies that it ever left behind for us was something that you might have touched on just a little bit in your introduction, and that was that I think it inspired countless numbers of young people who attended the fair. And you have to remember, this was in the years and the days before Walt Disney World and Epcot and all of the things that we have now. But it was attended by 51 million people, and a good number of those were kids. And I think that the legacy that the fair left behind for us is that it inspired a lot of those kids to go into technology fields after they had seen all of the wonderful things that lay in store for us in the future. Mm-hmm.
David Gelernter, did that happen in the 39 World's Fair too, do you think?
It certainly did to some extent. Technology was a huge theme at the 39 fair. There was a bigger underlying theme than technology. It was really a statement of absurdly defiant optimism in the face of a world that was really falling apart. And I think it probably inspired more people to a particular philosophy of life than it did to any career choice.
Mm-hmm. It gave them a renewed hope that the world wasn't falling apart?
Well, it made them optimistic.
Yeah.
It made them feel that despite the catastrophe that was impending and was then ongoing in Europe, the war began during the first season of the fair, and it was obvious that the United States was getting more and more involved. It gave them the strength of vision to think of what the world would be like afterward.
Mm-hmm. Was if you had to pick out one, you know, boffo technology that people saw at that fair, what would you say?
At the 1939 fair, the technologies that impressed people most were ones that changed the texture of everyday life.
Mm-hmm.
People were tremendously impressed by TV, and commercial TV broadcasting began on the opening day in April 1939 of the World's Fair. People were impressed by fluorescent lighting and by FM radio. and by Lucite and all sorts of new plastics that were on display, and by a fax machine, and by spotlights and other kinds of lighting technologies, and by other things that were going to matter not necessarily in terms of huge scientific or technical revolutions, but were going to matter to everyday life,
mm-hmm.
by an automatic dishwasher and by new electric appliances and things of that sort. There was a rocket ship and there was a robot and there was there were intelligent highways, but what mattered most was the technology that promised to be present in everybody's mm-hmm. life soon.
Did the war put off a lot of those things?
It's a mixed bag. In some ways, the war accelerated the advance of science and technology. Certainly, as far as electronics go, and in terms of the invention of computing, which was the one really big technology that was unforeseen by the fair, which was remarkably prescient in so many other ways, it certainly postponed the commercial advent of technologies like TV. Which were just getting underway in 1939 and never didn't pick up steam until after the war. Nylon stockings and miracle fibers and fabrics and so forth. So certainly in terms of consumer use of these technologies, things were postponed, mm-hmm. but more science and engineering was done during the years of the Second World War than during any other comparable period in history, mm-hmm. certainly.
Yeah. William Young, what technologies struck you about the 64 World's Fair?
I think probably at that time we were in the middle of the space race, or we were about in the midpoint of the space race in the mid-1960s. Sputnik had been launched in 1957 by the Soviets, and we were in a race with the Soviet Union, of course, to see who was going to be the first country to make it to the moon. So space was a huge theme at the fair. Lots of space vehicles on display in various state pavilions. Many of the states that had anything to do with the aerospace industry wanted to show the guests at the fair how they were participating in the space age, or in the space race. The NASA had hosted the U.S. Space Park outside of the Hall of Science, where they had displayed the largest collection of rockets north of Cape Canaveral area.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say space was a huge technological display there, and also computers. Dr. Glertner had mentioned also that computers was something that was not really foreseen back at the 39 World's Fair, but by the 1964 World's Fair, computers were very much on the scene, although not personal computers, but large-scale business computers. IBM had a huge exhibit at the fair showing people how computers worked and how they operated and how they were touching their lives.
Now, you could fill out a card or punch card in those days and
sure.
give it to them, and they'd come back with your birthday or something on it.
Exactly. They could fill out a little card, and they demonstrated how the optical character readers would be able to read the handwritten date on their card, and then they would load
yeah.
that into a computer, and it would retrieve a date from a headline from the New York Times from whatever date they put in there.
I was especially taken with that exhibit because that was the thing I did for my science fair project, was to build something that read those cards.
Okay, okay.
Card reader, so I remember that one in particular.
Sure.
The idea that the Unisphere, which still still is standing there in Flushing Meadow,
mm-hmm.
the giant globe, was the theme of the fair, I guess you could say.
Yes, exactly, the theme structure.
Mm-hmm. And that was the worldwideness and the universality of what was going on there, as opposed to, you know, it's a post-war era, we're like at the top of the world ourselves.
Sure. The Unisphere itself, the theme of the fair was peace through understanding. That was mm-hmm. the official theme of the fair, but it was dedicated to a theme that was called Man's Achievements on a Shrinking Globe in an Expanding Universe. And the Unisphere really symbolize that in that it was a large open globe, and it wasn't just a globe, it was a globe that mm-hmm. was surrounded by three orbital rings.
Yeah.
And the orbital rings, of course, represented space shots, some of the earliest space shots that had gone into space, the earliest space satellites or manned space explorations.
Let's see if I can get a call or two in here. Leslie from Little Rock, hi.
Hey, how are you?
Hi.
Well, I remember the 64 World's Fair. I lived not too far away on Long Island, and the two things that I remember most about it was, one was the family video telephone booth.
Ah, yes.
That was a big hit.
Yeah. It's the technology that never happened.
It's sort of almost happening now.
And now we have those little cameras on your computer.
Yeah, maybe. But the other big thing, the other big hit that I remember wasn't technology at all, but it was these incredible Belgian waffles. And I remember people used to talk. I mean, it might have been the first time Belgian waffles were introduced, at least in that area, just huge mounds of whipped cream, huge big strawberries, and that seemed to be when my friends came back from the fair. That's what they were all talking about.
And everyone remembers those waffles.
Everyone is still talking about
they
that.
Are,
I can't tell you the number of people that I talked to who
really?
I found at the fair that mentioned those Belgian waffles.
I know. It was a phenomenon.
I learned of the history. There was a celebration in Flushing Meadow last night. I went to it about for these two World's Fairs, and I asked about the waffles.
Really?
And I asked where they came from. And, of course, they came from Belgium. But they were shown, remember, there was a World's Fair before in Brussels.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right.
And they were shown at that World's Fair first and didn't get as much attention as they did in the Flushing Meadow World's Fair.
Sure, sure.
But they told me they're still being made in upstate New York at some little factory.
Yeah.
The same waffles. Hopefully not the same batter, but the same, you know, same. Well, yeah, that was interesting.
That was great.
All right, thanks for sharing that memory.
You're very welcome.
1-800-989-8255. Yeah, the food was interesting at the World's Fair. And you know, it was amazing that everybody tried to outdo each other's exhibit. And you had these... I always felt it so sad that they would spend such money and such effort to put up these giant buildings, and then they tore them down 2 years later.
Well, yes and no. I mean, it was a form of advertising, you know. I mean, especially when you look at the big corporations that put on shows in New York in 64 and 65. General Motors spent millions and millions of dollars to build their Futurama ride at the 64 World's Fair, but yet the attendance at the fair was predicted to be 70 million people. So, I mean, you were looking at General Motors being able to potentially play their show to almost half the population of the United States at the time, or a third of the population. So, I mean, it was a huge advertising gamble that they were taking.
You mentioned earlier, David, that there were certain the 39 was sort of a world of practical things that came out of it. Could you give us what you think a ballpark estimate would be about things that really did happen and things that were just so out of this world they never happened? Would most things did happen that they predicted?
I think by and large you have to say that the fair in 39 was amazingly on target almost across the board. The big predictions they made about the future direction of transportation, about the shift to the role of synthetic materials in all sorts of domains, from plastic to new forms of glass. The increasing role of electronic transmission of information. The idea of intelligent highways. The idea that rocket travel would eventually be on the agenda.
And the idea you could sit in this little boat and go around in a circle and hear it's a small world after all 1,000 times.
That was in 64, right?
That's right.
It's remarkable that you should say that the 1964 World's Fair was when we were on top of the world, because, of course, I think everybody has that memory of it. And yet today we are a vastly wealthier, vastly more powerful nation than we were in 1964 when we were locked in a bitter and dangerous Cold War. But unquestionably, the mood is very different. And we are much richer and we are much more powerful, but by no means are we happier. And you could probably extend that even farther back to today's mood versus 1939.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to take a break now. We've got to take a time out. We'll come back and talk lots more about the 64 and the 39 World's Fair. Also, we're going to bring in a St. Louis World's Fair that happened right at the turn of the century, 100 years ago. And it was a whole different image, whole different mood at that World's Fair. We'll talk about it, so stay with us.
Meet me in St. Louis, meet me at the fair. Don't tell me the lights are shining any place but there. We will dance the hoochie coochie. I will be your tootsie whoopsie if you will meet me in St. Louis, meet me at the fair.
Of course. What Judy Garland is singing about is the 1904 St. Louis World's Fair, or the Centennial Exhibition, which turns 100 years This year, of course, the fair ran for 7 months, attracted some 20 million people at the turn of the century in St. Louis. Fairgoers could see exhibits from 50 foreign countries, take a ride on the 260-foot-high Ferris wheel, see the usual sideshow freaks and contortionists, or visit one of the many so-called living anthropology exhibitions. That's an interesting exhibition we're going to talk about this hour on Science Friday. We are talking about world's fairs of the past and what they told us about our future and our culture. Joining me now to talk more about the St. Louis World's Fair is Robert Archibald. He is president and CEO of the Missouri Historical Society. The Society's exhibition on the fair opens May 2nd. He joins us by phone from Michigan. Thanks for being with us today, Dr. Archibald.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
We've been talking about the 64 and the 39 World's Fair, but the 04 St. Louis Fair was a whole different thing, was it not?
Well, in many respects it was, but it also carried one of those very powerful messages of optimism about the future. And, of course, in 1904 there were not the war clouds of World War II casting a shadow over the fair. So the tenor of the fair was unbridled optimism and a profound belief that through science and technology and medicine, the future looked brilliant and bright, and that ultimately all problems faced by humankind would be solved.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about some of the living anthropology displays at the fair. People were brought in from the Philippines and other countries sort of to live their lives as an exhibition?
That's true. There were more than 1,000 people brought from a variety of Filipino tribes. But that was part of the message of the anthropological exhibits, was that look at this dramatic contrast between the brilliant advances in science and industry and technology contrasted with what were regarded at the time as, quote, primitive societies and civilizations. And it was a point at which the United States felt a considerable obligation to somehow civilize and uplift other peoples around the world, an idea that, of course, is outmoded and has a racial undertone to it, but was very current at the time. And the fair was designed to impress upon the fairgoer the juxtaposition and the dramatic contrast between Filipino people and the modern marvels that were exhibited in the white palaces of the fair.
And that was the time where we were talking about the Spanish-American War, and was the fair used like this kind of exhibition, used like that to justify something like that?
Oh, I think truly it carried the same message and same justification that was used by President McKinley to justify the Spanish-American War, when he said that I stayed up all night wondering what to do about the Philippines and finally decided that we had a Christian and moral obligation to take over the Philippines in order to civilize and uplift them.
Mm-hmm. There was an African pygmy who was an exhibit.
A man by the name of Otabenga, who ended up in a zoo in New York and died, unfortunately, there. But a powerful and miserable and ugly message, which is the underside of the anthropological exhibits at the fair.
Mm-hmm. What did St. Louis have to do to prepare for the fair?
Well, it was, like many fairs, the opportunity for a dramatic remaking of the city. But, of course, in 1904, there's a dramatic contrast with 39 or 64. There is no radio, there's no television, there are no movies, people don't travel very much. And so in the period of several years, 10,000 workers created a 1,300-acre fairgrounds and built these alabaster white palaces, which were, of course, for the most part, temporary in nature. And they had also to rework the water supply, because one of the worst worries was that in all the water features and flowing waters on the fairgrounds, that they would have muddy Mississippi water flowing and cascading, which obviously wouldn't create a good impression. Mm-hmm. I think the other really striking piece of the fair that's remembered by the descendants of fairgoers, even in stories that have been passed along, is electric lights. Electric lights were obviously, for most people, a real novelty. And the fair was lit by electric lights that were the equivalent of 6.5 million candles. And so it was a dramatic and beautiful contrast in the minds of the fairgoers.
And a great ad for Thomas Edison.
A great ad. And, of course, Edison was the honorary electrical engineer for the fairgrounds and had an opportunity to exhibit a lot of the things that he had invented. And one of the things he was most concerned about at the time and that he was experimenting with was radium and X-rays, which for the first time were demonstrated at the 1904 fair.
So could you have your foot x-rayed? Or?
Yes, you could,
yeah,
with a fluoroscope. But by that point, Edison had become fearful of x-rays and of radium. And in fact, one of his assistants had died of a very serious cancer. And mm-hmm. Edison had begun to connect the x-ray with the cancer.
And of course, that was the early days of radio.
Absolutely.
Marconi era.
Yeah, I mean, it was the wireless telecommunication, and it was very early fax machines, and it was, as you say, radio, and it was...
Movies,
and a whole range of household appliances based on electricity. Curling irons, and automatic potato mashers, and automatic egg boilers, and all these things that promised the better life for people, and that was the underlying message of the fair. And I think that... like the 39 Fair and 64 Fair, the 1904 World's Fair was incredibly prescient about the future. I like to think of the 1904 World's Fair as an exhibition about the century that we just completed. And it was dramatically on target, even to the point of one of the very ebullient promoters of the automobiles on exhibit at the fair saying that this was going to make it possible for people to move out of the city and to have a one-acre lot out in the country while they still enjoyed and were able to travel back and forth to work in the city.
Talking about the World's Fairs with Robert Archibald, president of the Missouri Historical Society. Also with us is David Glernter, a professor of computer science at Yale, and William Young, co-author of the forthcoming book, Images of America, 1964-65, New York World's Fair. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Ruby in Hillsburg, California. Hi, Ruby.
Yes, I'd like to remind the rest of the nation about the opening of the Golden Gate Bridge. I was about 5 years old.
What year was that?
It was done for 2 years, so it was in connection with the World's Fair in New York.
Is that right?
38, 39.
David?
I was born in 33, and so my father said, we got to go see that. We went to Yerba Buena Island, and all the companies had things. And we had Danish dessert that was made out of fruit. That's something to remember. You've got to realize looking up at that bridge and somebody's coming around and giving you a sample, you know.
Your first Danish.
No, it's still a dessert that you can cook now.
No kidding.
David, I mean, still on the market.
David, do you remember that?
Bridges and dams all over the country were a huge growth area throughout the 1930s. The Golden Gate Bridge, probably the best example of classical deco streamlined architecture, but there were the Boulder Dam, now Hoover Dam, had just opened. The Grand Coulee Dam was under construction. The George Washington Bridge in New York was new, and the country was excited about bridges and tunnels and dams and huge civic projects in a way that LaGuardia Airport, which was near the fair, was brand new. In a way that's inconceivable today, when it's hard for us to build the smallest stretch of highway. In 1939, huge projects all over the country were celebrated in all over the fairground in all sorts of different ways.
Thanks for calling, Ruby.
And thank you for remembering the Golden Gate Bridge. You know, it became a world monument.
Oh, yeah. We partially think we own it, too, on this side of the country. Thank you. 1-800-989-8255. Are we too jaded to have World's Fairs now? I mean, does the Internet sort of made us so close together we don't even think about, you know, what's the big deal?
I think that people have so many other ways of acquainting themselves with modern technology and modern marvels that it would be very hard and very difficult to mount a World's Fair on the scale of the 1904 World's Fair. We simply have so many other ways of acquainting ourselves with modern marvels, whether it's television or movies or the Internet or radio or travel, that the idea of that kind of fair is probably obsolete.
It's true that the 39 Fair and the 64 Fair were both financial failures, and yet, although we have all sorts of other ways to learn about technology today, it's remarkable how much the population of the greater New York area misses the World's Fair. There was one for children in 1930 and 39, and then there was one for the next generation of children in the mid-60s, and then the next generation showed up, and there was no World's Fair, and people missed it, and there are people still talking about it and still asking why we can't do it again. And, of course, it's enormously expensive, and it was never made sense as a financial proposition. But people still like that sort of event.
Yeah.
And I don't think in any way, shape, or form the Internet satisfies their desire for spectacle and excitement of the sort that only a fair can provide.
You know, but when places like Epcot opened, I said to myself, look, here's sort of a miniature version of a World's Fair. Somebody, you know, Disney got it, and they're trying to reproduce it.
Sure, but and so much of that entertainment technology was debuted at the 64 New York World's Fair, but it doesn't have the sense of occasion that the World's Fair has had, the sense of a special event, the sense of being linked to the very latest new developments and being connected to the whole world and being the very latest thing that you had to see. That sense, I don't think, is anything like what is available at the standard theme parks that are all over today.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. We're talking about the World's Fair. Let's go to Jim in Duluth. Hi, Jim. Welcome to Science Friday. Jim, are you there?
This is Jim.
Go ahead.
You know, it's been really interesting and enjoyable to hear this conversation. The one thing that I have heard and what I hope we haven't lost is this thread of a continuum of hope and optimism. It seems to be the story of the history of world fairs. My personal experience was one with the 1964 World's Fair, and for me, it was Dad having brought home the new 64 Bonneville, and we all hopped in and headed off on a three-week excursion that the highlight of which started when we saw Unisphere and hopped on the little cars that the Greyhound had that played their theme over and over. Exactly. And, of course, saw those three high-rise structures that then were featured in the first Men in Black. Exciting times. I think I felt younger than my age. At 15, maybe you aren't supposed to be so wide-eyed as I was, but those were thrilling times. And having taken my children to Epcot about 20 years later when it first opened, I can't help but say that there was an echo as I saw the large globe, and even riding the, at the time, the GM exhibit seemed to me to carry very similar properties to the one that had existed at the 64 World's Fair.
And you must have gone on the It's a Small World ride while you were Disney World.
Yeah, Lindsay made us go on that about three times.
No comment.
Showed up in my sleep.
Me too. All right. Thanks for calling. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. We're talking about the World's Fairs of the past this hour and Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Robert Archibald, what items do you have on exhibit at the Historical Society? Have you got stuff left over from that fair?
Well, we were the legatees of what was left over from the fair. So we've got examples of scientific exhibits. We've got examples of all the kinds of souvenirs that were available at the fair. We've got all of the photographs of fair construction and fair operations and the fair events. So literally we've got photographs and images as well as objects from nearly all of the fair exhibitions.
Of course, there was no TV then to record it. Was there any film early? No, film wasn't developed.
Well, there's some kinescope, but primarily it's still photographs. But there are probably 20,000 images in existence of the 1904 World's Fair. And I have to say that it is remembered very fondly in St. Louis, although at this point there are very few people alive who actually visited it. But there is an urban mythology about it, which is about that spirit of optimism and that spirit of gathering people together and the excitement. But I also think that it was a different time from either 39 or 64, because the people who attended the 1904 World's Fair were absolutely astounded, because the fair so contrasted with their lives in tenements in cities and their lives in very isolated rural areas across the country. And they came in droves, taking trains to come and see the fair, and in some ways the juxtaposition of their real lives with what they saw at the fair was incredibly dramatic, and the memories became absolutely indelible.
Mm-hmm. William Young, your book, Images of America, coming up, 1964-65 New York World's Fair. Is that exactly what it is? Are they pictures?
It's primarily a photographic study of the fair, yes.
Mm-hmm.
There's a text that describes the pictures, but I've co-authored it with a fellow, Bill Cotter, who has been a longtime collector of photographs from the fair. And there's about 230 pictures from the New York World's Fair that are presented in the book. And it should be coming out the end of the summer or early fall.
How did you whittle down what you were going to put in there?
Well, we tried to stick to a theme in the book in that we wanted to show how the fair related to the era that we call the Space Age and also how it related to the Cold War. So we tried to pick some of the pictures then that would kind of fit in with that theme. And also making sure that we had plenty of pictures in there that were really representative of the fair. Like, I know there's pictures in there of people eating Belgian waffles.
Yeah. I get, as we say, they did put Belgian waffles on them. But there was other stuff to eat at the fair, wasn't there?
There was a lot to eat at the fair, yes. And the fair had restaurants in it from five-star restaurants down to fast food eateries. So you could have just about anything, which is the case at most World's Fairs.
And there's still a restaurant left over from the fair.
At the old heliport, the Port of Authority building, stands in the park, and it's now a catering facility. And they do a lot of weddings and things in there. I believe it's called Terrace on the Park now.
Yeah, I was there last night. And those two structures that, they're the left of the two towers, those roundish things that were in Men in Black, turned out to be flying saucers. Are those still operable, or what are they? They're not. Are they open to the public?
No, they're not. The pavilion actually has been in pretty terrible shape. It hasn't really been. It was the building that was designed by Philip Johnson and built for the state of New York for the New York World's Fair in 64 and 65, and it's really been pretty much abandoned since the early 1970s. And that elevator, I don't think, has probably worked. There's an elevator that's stuck in the middle of one of the towers that probably hasn't moved since about 1969.
Yeah, but the New York Hall of Science is there and going strong. And
exactly, yes. And it's a wonderful building.
It's a terrific place.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I got to say goodbye to all of you because we've run out of time. Thank you. David Glernter, professor of computer science at Yale University. William Young, a co-author of the forthcoming book, Images of America, 1965 New York World's Fair. Robert Archibald, President and CEO of the Missouri Historical Society. Thank you all for joining us this hour.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome. We're going to take a short break and come back and change subjects. We're going to talk about the Galapagos and a new play about it. Stay with us. We'll be right back.